Hey friends, welcome to another episode of the 10 Laws Podcast with East Forest. I am East, as sometimes I am called by people. I remember the first time someone called me East, I was like, oh, I guess that makes logical sense. And then, you know, over time you just get used to it, so that's one of the things I am called. This week I have a conversation with Martine Sherp, who is associated with the place called the Synthesis Retreat, which is a place in Amsterdam. He's the co-founder of this place. I believe he's the executive director. It's a place you can go to have legal psilocybin journeys that are guided in this beautiful place with all sorts of support. So he and I met at a conference, the Awaken Futures Conference in San Francisco, and I sort of was like, hey, man, we should talk. I really want to learn more about the details of what you're doing there. And moreover, I have this Music for Mushrooms record. I'd love for you to give it a try. So they did give it a try, and they've been using it in some sessions, and I got a chance to connect with him to hear more about it. So I think you're really going to enjoy the conversation. And for me, you know, I've been looking for places like this. You know, there's very few places now. We're just burgeoning where you can go and have a guided journey that's legal like this. Obviously, it's been happening on the underground for many years, but I'm exploring, in my own mind at least, places where I could go and host a journey for you guys. If you're feeling like you're feeling the call and you wanted to explore having a guided journey with live music and then integration time through a whole sort of retreat experience, places like this are where you can do that. And so it's great for me to get to know them, and I think you'll be into it too. I've been down here in Boulder, Utah with my sweet doggy Kaya. I've got her just for a couple weeks, and I wanted to bring her down here so we could get one last trip into the beautiful landscape of Southern Utah before the snows come and the winter comes, and I'm going to be mostly based out of Boise for the winter anyway. And thankfully, it's been so beautiful here. It's been warm. You know, it's been like 55, 60 degrees and sunny during the day. So we've been able to get out, had some epic hikes. And I just, over and over again, I'm struck by how this landscape is pure medicine. And it's medicine because it feels very raw. It feels very real. And I don't mean that lightly. I mean, I think one of the things that makes it feel powerful here is because I can sense the raw power of nature here. It's so in my face, and I'm just in it, and we haven't paved over it, so to speak. And that was evidenced by someone who got lost here recently, who I didn't know personally. His name was Everett Applegate. And I just, you know, we have a local email like chain in town to get messages out and questions when people sell stuff, things like that. And there's a message that this guy, Everett, was missing. And they were asking for help, or if anyone had seen him, or could you look for him? And it was on everyone's mind, because sometimes people go, they get lost here, they go missing. And, you know, I'm just, when I'm sitting here in my tiny house, as I like to call it, AKA a trailer, I'm just thinking about somebody else out there who's maybe hurt or lost or cold. And it's hard. It's hard to think about that. So he was out there, and, you know, a week went by and they still hadn't found him. And another week went by and they still hadn't found him. And after that, it's not good. And they didn't find him. And his family flew out, I think, from Massachusetts, and we organized, you know, search parties and the whole bit. But they did find him recently, and he was dead, obviously. And it was about, gosh, 5 or 6 weeks at least, or more. You know, he'd been there out there a while. And what was sad is that he wasn't that far from even the road, but he was down in a sort of a canyon, you know, a slot canyon. So really far down there, and he'd probably fallen, and I would imagine, because otherwise he would have gotten himself out of there. But his family wanted some photos of the site and sort of a GPS to where it was. So a friend of mine in here, he was heading down there to do that for him, and I went with him so he didn't have to go alone. And we were down there in the slot canyon. We had a general coordinates of where the rescuers had found his body. And we thought, well, maybe it was here. We see this sort of footprints here. Maybe it was here, but we weren't sure. And we kept going down the canyon, and I was standing and I looked down to my side and I saw sort of a makeshift bed made out of needles and rocks. And I was like, oh my God, it's here. He made this. And it really hit home. What was even more powerful is then we stepped down about 10 feet down and there was a rock, sort of what you'd consider the low point of the slot canyon. You know, if anyone was to walk by, this is where they'd walk by. And on the rock was scratched into it. It said, help, with an arrow pointing to where his bed was, the date, and it said injured. And seeing that took our breath away because it was obviously so recent, but just thinking about, he was right there. He's right there as a crow flies. I think he was 300 feet from the road. And all these people driving by, but no one could hear him. No one could see him. It looked like he tried to start a fire to get some smoke going. And I just feel for that soul forever. I burned some smoke for him down there to clear it, to try to just move whatever was down there, stuck. And we built an altar for him to just mark that. So I know it's the soul's journey. I know we all have our complicated karma. And I know everything's perfect. And I know that was also horrible for him. And I know that he suffered. And I'm sorry for that. And I feel for him as another human being on this planet. And so Everett Applegate, rest in peace. But in a weird way, those kinds of occurrences is what makes this place feel even more charged, because I know it's that real. It's like one misstep away from being lost and that's it. And something about that reminds me of my mortality, and it reminds me of the seasons, and it reminds me of, you know, protecting my feet and watching where I'm going and being conscientious and slowing down. And these are all things that are good and healthy and all things that make me feel more alive. Are they humbling? Yes. Are they scary at times? But is this place charging? Yeah, there's something about that that charges up the life in you. And that's one of the reasons why I like coming down here. It does something to feed me. And I hope that I can take that energy and bring it out into the world through my own beingness and energy and my creative work. So we're going to get into this conversation with Martin because, you know, at the end of the day, the people who are doing the psilocybin work and traveling all the way to Amsterdam to do it, there's a kind of suffering there. And there's also a part of them that knows there's a more beautiful world possible. And they just want to help make it happen, as opposed to not. And they have a choice. They really do. They don't have to go there and do this work. It's not about getting high. It's about it's about fulfilling that human need to grow and to do better, because we can, and we know that we can. So on that, let's dive into this conversation. Cool. So are you, I take it you're in Amsterdam right now.
I am in Haarlem, which is 15 minutes just outside of Amsterdam.
I've been there. Hey, we started recording at 11:11 my time.
Perfect.
Awesome. What time is it there? It's pretty late, right?
It's 6:13. It's getting at the end of the day. It's been a long day. So I'm just going to chill and enjoy this.
What have you been up to today?
Today, it's been a day full of meetings. Basically, we are onboarding a lot of new team members, raising the next round of investment, really figuring out like what is our role within the psychedelic space. Startup mode. So it's full on every day.
So this is all meetings that you're doing for Synthesis?
Correct. Yeah, Synthesis is now full time.
Okay.
Or double full time, if I'm really honest.
Okay. Let's get a little background here so we can get into the weeds about what's going on, just so people understand what we're talking about. Tell us your little update, or give us a little background on what Synthesis is, so we can talk about what you're doing.
Sure. Synthesis is a legal psilocybin center in the Netherlands where we offer high doses of psilocybin for transformation. And at Synthesis, we bring together diverse fields like psychiatry as well as shamanism into like a holistic model that I think really honors the whole range of psychedelic experience people can have, from the healing side to, you know, working with people that have subclinical diagnoses of depression or like, you know, little addictions. We're not a treatment clinic, so we don't have the infrastructure to really help people with very bad cases. But let's say people want to quit smoking, etc., or they maybe drink too much, or they don't have a healthy relationship with food. That's definitely possible to work on, as well as people that want to find more purpose in their lives or find meaning. And then there's a group of people that want to come because they're just mystically curious. They want to explore the full range of human experiences.
What about people who are experiencing some form of trauma, PTSD, in addition to well people who want to feel more well?
So it's now mostly people who already feel well, they're high functioning, and that is something that our center is equipped for. We do have medical professionals at hand during the ceremonies. We do work with psychotherapists and clinical psychologists, but we feel the space is so early and the research is still kind of out there. It's still very early that we don't work with people that we feel need a longer trajectory of therapy. So we don't actually offer psychedelic therapy, but we are really excited to move in that space over time once we feel ready and we can really offer the care that these individuals need.
So the kind of care you're saying that might be needed, is that more like in the post, in the integration? Because I would imagine the experience itself might be the same for someone who feels okay versus who is looking for a specific thing.
Yeah, it's a lot of things, actually. It's making sure they've done the pre-work. They have a therapist at home they can see, and they see regularly. It is about and really making sure they have the support network. I think we can help most of them already. It's just that we don't know who can fall through the cracks, and we want 100% success rate on that, because we really want to live by the motto "do no harm," and we're just not ready for that at this time. And then, of course, the integration as well,
right? Yeah. So, through your screening process, because people sort of apply to come work with you, you're actually accepting more people who. Well, it's funny because the model here in the States is so focused around psychedelic therapy as sort of the viable and valuable way to go through this. And over there, you're saying that's valuable, of course, but you're sort of starting from a place where people are not coming in with larger psychological or emotional traumas.
Correct. So we basically kind of operate outside of the clinical model, but with clinical standards. And right now, unfortunately, we reject about 40% of all people that apply. And that's simply because we don't want to risk the space. Like, we know we're very early. We're a for-profit company, so we need to be really careful on who we take money from and make sure we don't overstep our boundaries and, for example, do anything that might harm the research that's going out, because that might set the whole space back, and that's something simply we're not interested in doing.
So when you say harm the research, you mean the research that's being done by the entire psychedelic worldwide community? Mm-hmm. Because perhaps when you think, what kind of boundaries do you think you would overstep? Like, what is it you're, tell me what you're afraid might happen.
Well, an example would be, let's say we say, hey, we do accept people with depression, and mm-hmm. we don't offer the same care that some of these clinical trials do. And either this person gets worse, you know, with all the inherent risks, and that comes out in the media, it might set back the believability or the enthusiasm that kind of supports the research. So I think we're just very early, and we are building the infrastructure to help these people, but we're not there yet. So we want to be just really honest and making sure we do no harm.
Well, that's really admirable, because, you know, I think maybe I'm just looking at it from like an American model. I think mm-hmm. most, you know, another attitude would be like, well, they might not be harmed, but they just might not get the same level of benefit they might get inside a research institution. But if they're coming to say, get a piece of therapy from you, and this is one piece of a larger picture of their life, you're not responsible for the entire picture of how well they get. Like, that's sort mm-hmm. of on them. And it might end up being a larger holistic picture that involves different modalities combined with what you're doing. And absolutely, it'd be awesome if sort of like you guys were the centerpiece of that, and you helped coordinate the care from start to finish, from diet to psychological help over a course of months or even a year. But perhaps that also is, it's overambitious. It's like when I go to get, I don't know, acupuncture, right? Mm-hmm. It's sort of like that's an isolated experience that I am choosing myself to go. And I have certain expectations from that practitioner. And they ask me about my life and this and that, but it's sort of like you're setting yourself up, and perhaps rightly so, with a psilocybin center for profit that's offering people deep dives into the soul mm-hmm. to say like, hey, the only way to do this is one that is completely holistic, where, you know, we're looking at your entire life and we're going to help you connect the dots. Mm-hmm. It's a tall order. And I'm hearing you say that you recognize that.
It is. And I think for most people that are suffering from depression, that they want to taper off from SSRIs, or they struggle with things like alcoholism, I think we can help, and our models, I think, are amazing. And we see the results on a week-to-week basis. We have a research partnership with Imperial College in London, and, you know, the improvement in well-being and depression scores, and the improvement in anxiety and connectedness, etc., are off the charts. They're really, really great. But what we want to be cognizant about is not promising anything. That's one. And mm-hmm. that this doesn't work for everyone. That's second. And right. for some that it might work, it might get worse after. So in a clinical trial, you know you have 2 to 3 sessions. You know you have psychotherapy before and after. And even though I know that some people do fall through the cracks in research, it's a bit more contained. And so we don't want to have someone come in and have a very challenging experience that they have difficulty integrating, and then get lost when they move back. They have nobody to talk to. And so
yeah,
we, for example, slowly started accepting people with subclinical diagnoses. And some of the things that we do is have multiple intake calls. We make sure they have a therapist, they have support network, they started meditating, they started doing all these other things to be fully ready for this experience, because it's not a just you take a pill and you're fixed. It is
sure,
actually
yeah.
a lot of work. And yeah, it just takes time. Like, we're only a year, year and a half old. We're a very young startup. And we know where we're lacking. And before we build that, it's just not, we have to disappoint a lot of people. And that's kind of pains my heart, because some people are really desperate and they tried everything, and it's very likely this will help. And we do really believe in the model we build and the standards that we adhere ourselves to. But we need to be patient as well.
So So you guys are working largely with psilocybin. Why is that? As you know, there's a huge international underground world of ayahuasca work where people are just diving into the depths and just going for it in a model that has been done in some ways for thousands of years, at least if you go the traditional route. And then you guys are saying, hey, we want to work with psilocybin. Why is that?
I think there are a few reasons. So my background is partly, at least my personal transformation in psychedelics has been in with ayahuasca and yahe specifically. And I believe the wisdom tradition and the tradition of practitioners is a really beautiful one, and I think it can help a lot of people. That said, I think there are elements to the ayahuasca cosmology that I think from a Western standpoint is very hard to fully understand. It's even harder to fully integrate. We don't have the same social network that some of these tribes do there. If you take ayahuasca one day, you know, the integration is when you work on the farm, when you go hunting, when you sing the songs while or fishing or weaving the hammocks, for example. And we don't have that here. So I think it's sometimes troublesome to see people doing deep dives in ayahuasca and they come back and they're trying to adopt new language that doesn't really fit our modern identity, ego, structure of consciousness. So that's one reason. Like, we didn't want to co-opt traditions that it's just not our lineage. Second, and this is also a really big reason, ayahuasca is not legal here. And so, and psilocybin truffles are. And so from a legal perspective, we want to make sure everything is by the book. We're fully transparent. And I don't think that's possible right now with ayahuasca. And then the third, most of the promising research is based on psilocybin. I think the growth of psilocybin research outpaces anything else. And so I think if we want to work towards a model that becomes more accessible and will potentially even be covered by insurance, I think psilocybin will be the clear winner. And then you have things like physical discomfort and ingesting plant material, not sourcing, like the ecological crisis of is happening all over. So we don't want to exploit natural resources. There are a lot of reasons.
Well, tell me about these truffles. What is the medicine itself? Is it like a fresh mushroom that's ground into, or what is it? Or how are you getting this? Who makes it?
There are a few growers here in the Netherlands that have been doing this for about 40 years. They don't grow the mushroom because for some really strange and weird reason, the mushroom itself is illegal and the truffle is legal. So as long as the mycelium remains underground and starts to create the food reserve of the mushroom, it's fine. It's the Sclerotoria of the mushroom. But the moment it peeks its head above the ground, it becomes illegal.
Wow. So I was not aware that the mycelium had psilocybin in it.
Yeah, so it creates the truffle, which is kind of folded mycelium parts that happens when the mushroom can grow above ground. So it kind of prepares itself for better conditions later on.
Fascinating. It's funny because, you know, here in the States, there's a lot of talk about compass pathways and companies that are positioning themselves to synthesize psilocybin to be sort of like this sole supplier from a pharmaceutical standpoint, because a lot of clinical trials, or when it becomes medicalized, there's a standardization about dosage. And I think people would say, oh, we can't use a medicine that, I don't know, grows in the ground or is from this or that, because they need their dosages to be really consistent. And that's interesting. That are they using, do you know, in like Imperial College, that same type of delivery system that you guys are using?
So Imperial and a few other research institutes, they use Compass Pathways, GMP, Good Manufacturing Product, psilocybin. And this basically means it's extremely pure, that you know exactly what you're taking, it's consistent over time, and the rationale for that is a very, I think, kind of outdated model that comes from clinical, where the dose really matters. And to a certain extent, that's true for psilocybin as well, and for other plant medicines like THC or etc. Although we do see with psychedelics, there's not as clear dose outcome response. There are all kinds of mediators that you could put in, for example, set and setting that kind of influence it. So one of them is, of course, the mystical experience. Like if you had a mystical experience, the chance of you doing better is higher. And you can have a mystical experience on the same dose that another person has a very difficult experience and no emotional breakthrough. And that makes psychedelics very strange, alien to the clinical model. But yeah, it's strange. Like these things grow everywhere. They've been used for thousands of years. And they contain not just psilocybin, but also psilocin, bayacin, and then there's a whole range of other psilocybin, psilocin derivatives that are modulators that definitely change the experience. So if you use different strains, for example, every single strain has their own quality. And I think just focusing on the clinical model, there's a lot of things that can go missing. I'm personally not necessarily a fan of that.
What strain are you guys using? We're finding success with.
So right now we use the psilocybin mexicana. There's not much available here in the Netherlands. There are a few, there are tampanensis and cubensis as well. Cubensis is historically.
Basically, if the mexicana strain, it's still cubensis, right? Is the main ingredient or the active ingredient?
So
is this is it the same? I'm just curious, like if you had a particular strain that you're finding has like been working for you guys versus others.
So we basically only use the strains that are available to us, but we love to explore other strains that have been more revered and appreciated over time. We know that Maria Sabina historically refused to work with the cubensis. They had like a dark energy to it, and there are different ways to make an interpretation of that statement. But I think there is a huge difference between different strains of mushrooms. If you look at the Asurensis, it's very very different experience than the Cubensis. And but we're in the very early stages of finding out ways to work with those as well.
What did Maria Sabina work with? What strain?
It's very hard to pronounce. I think Curensis something.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so they actually got a few from a friend recently that were from very close to her house, and I haven't tried them yet, but everyone who's been growing them for a while or has tried enough of them, they say there are significant differences.
That is fascinating. Yeah, cubensis, it's like, it's such a powerful, powerful compound. You know, I mean, things can be profoundly mystical and blissful and deep and, I mean, profoundly. And it also can have a profoundly chaotic energy at times in the way, and my experiences over my life have been so different, and I don't have an explanation to why sometimes, sometimes you can point to the thing that maybe threw you off course, and sometimes I can't, and that's what that sort of rolling of the dice is. I mean, this might be the scariest thing for people with psychedelics in general. But, you know, I recently had a therapeutic experience with ketamine, and I was kind of shocked by how psychedelic it was. And something about the nature of the ketamine itself, like, there's almost no anxiety, you know, very little, as you're moving into those deep spaces. And I think that has to do with the compound itself.
Right.
And I'm just thinking about these models, you know, what works best for people. Because, as I'm sure you've discovered, you know, especially with ayahuasca and psilocybin and LSD and so forth, part of it is in some ways breaking through something and going through a certain dark night of the soul at times. And that's part of the whole journey often. What do you guys find with working with the darkness and the challenges that come up for people in the space?
It happens. We don't really like to talk about bad trips. We often frame it that these are challenging, and often the most challenging can be the most healing. Often it is a part of our own lives or stories that we have repressed for whatever reason, trauma, and we've been carrying that for many years. And part of that is re-experiencing them. Part of it is the emotional intensity and the disorientation that comes with it. And what is really important is to make sure that people know they're under influence, that they are completely safe, and they can work through it. And so we do a lot of preparation and guidance around confronting, opening up to, exploring, especially the things that unsettle them. And we see wonderful results, often the biggest breakthroughs.
Have you been able to figure out a way to pre-screen the small number of people, very small number, who when they get into higher dose situations, they kind of black out and maybe lose control of their physical body? Like, they could get up and want to, I mean, it's, then they won't remember this, you know, and they want to like run outside or like that kind of physical loss of control.
Yeah, we do a few things that either suggest we should adjust the dose or reject someone altogether. One of them is a tendency to dissociate. And so talk about their emotions in third person, saying things, I'd like to escape the experience. I just want to get rid of this. Like all kinds of psychological manners to run away from the suffering. And what we know, it's actually that makes us sick. We want to connect to the suffering because the suffering is inherently meaningful, as well as so much woven into our being that escaping from that means escaping from our whole nature. And thus, we really make sure people are ready. They're ready to surrender. They're ready to let go. And these things are already inherently, without a psychedelic, quite scary for most people. And so it is, I think, our responsibility to tell people, hey, you're probably not ready. And this happens on our exploration calls, where we tell, like, hey, it might not be the right time for you. Please do some of this work first. We recommend therapy or meditation or other spiritual practices. And then once you get settled and this is something you can approach with more curiosity, then come back.
Wow. And are most of the experiences you guys are hosting, I looked at your website, are they group experiences, like 3-day retreats? Or are there also other modalities like one-on-one?
So we do 3-day retreats, 5-day retreats, one-on-one private sessions, as well as a women's leadership retreat. And we're probably in 2020, we're also launching a men's leadership retreat and a Buddhist-focused retreat. So that has a lot more contemplative Buddhist practice as well. Yeah, that's kind of the offerings that we have.
And what kind of dosaging have you found? Is there a sweet spot, or is it all over the place depending on the person?
No, there's definitely a sweet spot, and I think the research is close to it. I think the research in general, you can trace back what the first assumptions were of the first studies, and for the researchers, just to stay safe, they kind of copied some of these models. So one of them, for which there is no scientific evidence at all, is, for example, doses based on body weight. That doesn't hold true whatsoever. Another one is probably the effective dose is around 25 milligrams of psilocybin. I think that's close. We kind of work with slightly higher. And that's simply because it doesn't seem to have a big negative effect. People on our retreat are definitely ready to do that, to do go deeper. And it makes sure that everybody has an experience. So if you go with 25 or lower, then there is a group of people that they just needed a bit more. And now they kind of, I wouldn't say wasted an opportunity, because it's still deeply transformational. And the retreat itself, I think if you come and you don't take a psychedelic at all, it's still an amazing transformational experience, but it's not optimal.
So is 25 milligrams, does that equate to like 2.5 to 3 grams as much in a typical dried mushroom?
Give or take. Of course, depending on the species, there are, you know, the Hawaiians or the Acerensis or the ones that Mary Sabina took there, they seem to be close to twice as potent. But yeah.
So what are you finding working for you, man? I mean, you're out there on the vanguard, the spear tip of doing this. There are very few places like this. I know there's a place in Jamaica, I think, that you can do similar work.
In Jamaica where you could have such an experience. We really have an amazing team that I think is very, very passionate, has a deep, deep roots in the psychedelic community as such. And working with clinical standards, but outside of the clinical model, and being the first psychedelic startup, it's been a really wild ride. Lots of learning, lots of growth, and I think a lot more exciting things to come.
So, I mean, what can you tell us for the people who maybe want to do this kind of stuff in the future or are making plans here in the States already, whether it's, you know, we're wanting to do events or put together retreats that are above board?
Mm-hmm.
What are some things that have come up for you that maybe you can give us a heads up on, some challenges or successes too?
Well, first of all, it is really beautiful work and it's really fulfilling. I hope there will be more access, and because there is a lot of healing to be done in this world. I think we learned this, like what's the structure of a retreat, like who should lead it, what kind of experience, how to make sure a team is run smoothly. One of the things we started doing is external supervision. I think that's really needed, like transparent checks and balances. Training. It has so many logistical things that need to be communicated. So from the person first applying to an exploration call, to what they say, what kind of what our intuition says, what kind of interpretation we need to make about this person's well-being, if they're ready or not, that all needs to be communicated to the retreat. And one of the things we found a lot of value in is like one-on-one time with your facilitator. That's, for example, an ayahuasca that's unheard of. That's basically the medicine does the work. And there's a very strong belief in, you know, the mushroom will just tell everyone what they need to hear. And from the research and in our experience, that's just simply not true. It's true for some people, some of the time. But there's a lot of hand-holding or guidance you can do as well. And then there's like learning what kind of modalities work with the yoga, meditation, breath work, etc. What kind of education people need, other wellness elements, etc. It's a lot more difficult than you think.
I know.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of people that want to move into the space and they simply don't have the credentials. They do have a very beautiful aspiration, but Some of them haven't even worked for a few years in a lineage, or they, you know, they don't have a clinical or coaching background, and they feel like anybody can do this. And I think that's a mistake and quite risky.
You mentioned like intuition and the role that plays when you're dealing with people and talking to them and the intake. You know, it's something that's very unscientific traditionally, but I would agree that on some level, there's only so much we can quantify. And, you know, on certain things, a lot of things, especially during the experience, there's an intuitive hit about what needs to be done, what doesn't need to be done, what person, what dosage, all these things that I think kind of, they do come down to you. You pull all this information together, then you just kind of like feel it, like what is needed.
Right.
And that is a challenging thing. You know, that's just kind of a gift people can have about how tapped in are they to experience. Absolutely plays a role, as you're saying, like all these things definitely matter.
Experience is huge. Training in other modalities, contemplative practices is huge. Psycho-spiritual understanding of developmental psychology to transpersonal psychology, I think, is extremely important. And then, you know, a natural inclination of compassion, openness to other people's stories, like a genuine interest. You need to be somewhat conscientious, because you need that, that creates trust. If you're sloppy and chaotic, it doesn't need, you know, it doesn't really provide a safe container. So it's quite an amazing growth our team has gone through since a year. For example, one of the things we learned is people should not facilitate more than 2 retreats a month. It's, if not, it's just too much. And people get burned out quite quickly doing this work, because you you re-experience some of these states with the client, and you need to travel with them in some level. So, yeah.
How much are you bringing in from traditional practices of like protecting your own psychic space and not like feeling like you're just taking on the spiritual cosmic detritus that comes in on a journey?
That's a huge part. We have special rituals for the team before and after the retreat, forms of debrief, forms of supervision, team circles, etc., to make sure, and also like practice like meditation and breath work, to make sure their own vehicles for transformation, their own being is clean, but also present, ready to be fully in service of the experience the client can have. And then the same with the space. So we really treat our retreat venue, which is a redesigned church for transformational retreats, really like a sacred holy place. It's a temple.
It's beautiful. I saw the photos. It looks stunning.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. It's one of the most beautiful places I've been. And we're so grateful to do this work in such a place that has a rich history and was a cornerstone for the community, a place of worship, and now people come from all over the world, and they have some of the most transformational, deep, like I said, a deep dive into the soul type of experience. And it's kind of funny, because we have this shuttle service that works with us that makes sure everyone arrive safely and come and is dropped off at the airport or central station safely. And, you know, these people have no clue what we're doing, but and so when you ask them, what do you make of this? They say, I don't really know what's happening, but we get a lot of stressed out Americans that come in, and then after they just completely change, and they're the most friendly people ever.
And, there you go.
And it makes, of course, go. It makes sense, because people are a bit anxious and might feel some trepidation beforehand, and after it's like this big release. But it's such a deep transformation. Like, one of the reasons why I personally do this work is that I haven't found a tool or a tradition or sacrament that is as powerful as combining contemplative wisdom traditions with a psychedelic catalyst. I don't think there's anything that comes close to the outcomes that we see.
Well, I've always had a, you know, East Forest started in this space 11 years ago, and I always had a dream of opening basically what you're doing and creating a standardized protocol that is, can be scaled and repeated so there could be many centers. And, you know, for me, as we talked about when we met, the music plays a really big role in the ceremony itself. And when you're inside the experience, I find that the music is the central guide. And architecture, it creates an architecture that you're actually inside of, especially if you're doing a closed eye experience. So it's a really, really critical aspect of the experience itself. And it could be an experience that's important for the integration if you're using the same music or similar music afterwards as a way of sort of making a bridge between the peak experience itself and then day-to-day life and, you know, what, how to connect the dots. So
yeah, we resonate with that.
What are you doing with music, you know?
Yeah, so we do a few things. In psychedelic therapy, they call music the hidden therapist. And I really like that because it seems to offer the psyche a canvas to restructure and recalibrate parts of the our being that are not in alignment, that are not, the things that are not serving us any longer. And
I love that description.
Yeah, and that's kind of what we see. And so music, as you know, it's traditionally, or even if you look at other forms of initiation in modern culture, people get drunk and they rave. You know, music is such a binder or vehicle for these journeys. And so when we started out, we worked with the playlist that has been used in some of the psilocybin ceremonies studies in the beginning.
Oh, no.
Sorry?
I said, oh, no. I just have my strong feelings about like the old school playlist that like John Hopkins put out and stuff.
So we didn't use the John Hopkins one. We used the one with Mendel Kahlen. That's been working really well. We actually used your playlist on a retreat we did last week. We launched our 5-day program, and that was extremely well received. So, congrats!
The Music for Mushrooms album,
Music for Mushrooms, and the truffles liked it as well.
Yeah, I made a playlist years ago. I actually forgot about it. It's on Spotify. I think it's called Music to Journey To. And it's a 5-hour playlist, mostly of my music and some other people's. And I completely forgot about it. And then I made the Music for Mushrooms album, which I feel like is sort of the apex of my thinking around that and the music. You know, it was created live in the space during a ceremony. I just felt like it was very imbued with the medicine of psilocybin. But someone recently was referencing, oh, we used your playlist, and they actually meant that playlist I made on Spotify, which I'd forgotten about. So I actually checked it out last night and was like, what's on there? I said, make sure this is, I still stand behind this. Uh-huh. I was like, oh, that's pretty good. It's a pretty good arc.
Cool. Yeah, I think you offer an amazing service to this community by bringing some of these elements together, like this quality of journeying, but also the nature relatedness.
That's a big thing.
Yeah, and I really love that about your music.
Yeah, I think it helps. I think it really, you know, as you know, a lot of people when they're in the psilocybin space, there's a connection to the earth and to nature and themselves in it, And I love bringing in those sounds of wilderness, of the earth, into the music, into the experience. I found it to be soothing, but I also find it to be deeply moving and inspirational, and a kind of rest too, like in between songs, to just be resting in like a sea of crickets.
Yeah, it's really interesting because we work a lot with scientists, and my background is in interdisciplinary science, and I love to geek out on this stuff. And one of the experts on the nature relatedness that seems to increase significantly after psychedelic, even if people didn't take a psychedelic in nature, it really baffles. But it seems to be that we have this natural predisposition to listen or resonate with or open ourselves up or feel at home with some of these sounds. And that's my experience, especially when you're really sensitive on the psychedelic. It feels like coming home. And
I think it is, right? Like it's in our epigenetic codes and our history going back to the beginning of humanity, the sound of a fire in the Stone Age, right? And how that separated us from the night. And beyond the fact that these large sounds, like us, they entrain the brain, like the chaos of a million crickets, you know, it does something to calm you down.
Yeah. And
indigenous cultures called them portal openers. And I think that was the reason, because if you meditate to them or allow yourself to sink into it, it takes you somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is one of the reasons why we always work with a fire. And it's not in a ceremonial space, but if people go into the, so we have a ceremonial space and then it's next to the church, and in the middle of the church, there's a fire. And at the end of the ceremony, there's always a few people just sitting around in contemplative awareness, looking into the fire. And there's this amazing element that, you know, the first element we controlled, and that's given us so much. It has this mystical, magical quality to it if you really deeply unite your consciousness with it. And it's amazing to see business executives or bankers or lawyers to come in, have their first psychedelic experience and reawaken that connection. It always gives me a chuckle.
The human they are.
Yeah.
Have you ever worked with other elements? Like, I've noticed something that can help with anxiety before a session, if it's available, is to take a sauna and then maybe do like a cold dunk or a steam room, where it's just water, you know, wetness and heat in that sense.
So
do you ever do those sort of full body type things?
Yeah, we have a sauna available, so people can use that as preparation. We often start the program with breathwork, a model that we create ourselves based on different breathwork modalities that are out there that works really, really well for people to prepare. We also work with other shamanistic tools like smoke, smudging, different flora water at different times to reawaken the senses, to make people really aware that our memory, our well-being, the way we perceive ritual meaning and intentions are all extremely interconnected. And it's kind of like woo-woo if you haven't had this experience before. But if you're in this space, like...
Sure makes sense when you're in it.
One of the most common things we hear, and this is, in a way, it's really funny, is when they come to the retreat, they some or most people, they're quite successful, rational, high functioning. They listen to Sam Harris, Tim Ferriss, that kind of Michael. They've read Michael Pollan's book, and they like the scientific evidence-based information that they get from us. And then, you know, we make it into a ritual. We have a tea ritual when they start. And then we smudge people and like, I didn't know about that. It was kind of like, suddenly become spiritual. And the most common remark people make after is like, wow, now I understand that. Now I understand the reason why you guys did that. In the beginning, I didn't get that at all. But
Yeah, it's connected to a felt experience in their body. It's encoded now. It was like they can't argue with how the clarity and truth that they felt something in the experience. That was theirs alone, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't an idea. And now that's, I think, why people continue to bring those things into their life or have a little altar, because just the smell of the sage or the Palo Santo in the morning or when they're feeling a little off brings back that memory in their emotional being to help bring them back to center. As opposed to thinking like maybe, even if it's not like, oh, this is actually clearing the space. So when people experience that inside the ceremony, like the smudging and so forth, it has a real truth to them. And so they end up bringing it into their lives, I find. And so I'm glad that you're incorporating that and recognizing as well the role of music. And that's something I've known for a long time. You know, I was doing this like in the underground. Mm. And it's all just sort of anecdotal, what works, really. We're just seeing like what works. And I was trying to develop a protocol to see what took people through the experience in a way that was the most beneficial to them. And I'm just trying to create music that, and a whole system around that music, a ceremony that would kind of work. And so it's kind of fun to think that you guys are all the way over there in Amsterdam and getting mm-hmm. people from all over the world, and that same music that was developed with, you know, small private communities over the years is working for you too.
Yeah, it's amazing. We draw up on a lot of underground knowledge, shamanistic practices, other wisdom cultures, research. And we're really in depth, I think, in a lot of ways to be able to do this. I don't think it would have been able to work any other time.
Well, it really takes some very sober people with their head on their shoulders to think about this holistically, to do what you're doing, because not only are you bringing in some pretty serious energies figuratively and cosmically, but then you're working at the front of the train of something that has a ton of interest around it right now, and there's no leadership on how to move forward. So I applaud you for giving it a go and doing this experimentation for all of us.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, it's definitely an exciting time. I think there's a lot of interest and a lot of need. And then there's a lot of players moving in with different intentions. Some are good, but unwise. Some are not good and profit-driven or exploitatory minded. And it's going to be an interesting ride to see how this develops. I just want to make sure, you know, we keep honoring the sacred within us in a way that really does right to what these medicines could mean to us as a community, to our species. And I think we have an amazing opportunity here, and I don't think we get to do it more than a few times. As in, we have to really do it well, and that means doing it together. So I'm actually personally very grateful to all my teachers and all the partnerships that we've built. It's been an amazing journey.
Well, and as you said at the beginning, correct me if I'm wrong, but you are doing this as a for-profit business, and if you guys are putting all this time into it, we live in a world where you're trying to make a living and make this all sustainable for everybody, and that's a fine line. You know, I'm really doing a similar thing in the sense that I've devoted my life to what I consider to be a spiritual practice, but it's also a business. That is this whole world of East Forest and out there performing, and we're mixing worlds. And as I think we have to, and as we should, but it is something that takes a recalibration really daily to make sure you feel like you're balanced and you're on the course.
Yeah, I think inherently a for-profit does skew your incentives in some way that makes you blind, like inherently so, and there's not much you can do about that, except like getting external checks and balances and make sure you're very transparent. We are interested in and very likely to create a nonprofit as well, where we're going to put some of the research and the treatment, simply because that's a model that I think works better for that specific thing. But if, like, look at, for example, like Compass again, if you want to scale access, the for-profit model is faster and better, I think. So even Maps created a for-profit public benefit corporation recently. And
yeah.
And I think like these hybrid models are very, very interesting. Like really looking at who are stakeholders, how can we empower indigenous communities that are keepers of this knowledge? How can we make sure, in a way, and this might sound extremely sacrilegious, but make being a curandera sexy again, because you know, these traditions are dying out and it's not cool because there's no money, it's arduous training, there's no future. But I think you know, we kind of know a lot of things about marketing and sales and empowered beliefs, and I think there are ways to reignite these communities. Of course, with all the sensitivity around us coming in from the outside and basically having very little to no understanding of what it's actually like to be a marginalized, part of a marginalized community. But it is our responsibility to make sure we work together and, you know, that our bottom line is not just profit, but it's also people, purpose, and planet. What I call
triple bottom line, yeah.
Yeah, quadruple bottom line. It's kind of the hot thing in town right now. And yeah, how does it look like in the psychedelic space? And I am thinking about that almost every day to think about, like, if this keeps growing like it has, which means that this will become a significant voice in how we actually integrate these medicines and sacraments after hundreds of years of misinformation, stigmatization, repression. It's a big responsibility, and like, I'm well aware I can't do this alone or my team. So we are very active in collaboration.
Well, there are many others on this planet wanting to do the same, and hopefully we can start to have conversations like we're having right now and work together from what we've learned from our mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll get it done. It's happening.
That'd be great. Yeah.
It's definitely happening.
It's so happening, and I'm so excited for what we can accomplish in this lifetime.
Well, thanks for giving some time. How can people check out this place and what you're up to if they want to learn more? See if they're in the 60% who are ready.
Yeah, if this is something you feel like, hey, this could benefit you, or you're just interested in how we operate, you can visit our website, synthesisretreat.com, or check out our social Synthesis RTRT. And you can contact me, Martijn, at Synthesis, if you have ideas or want to collaborate. We're extremely transparent on our research and how we operate. And I'm looking forward to continue our work.
Great, man. Well, keep it up. Keep doing what you're doing.
Likewise. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you, Martijn, for giving us your time. I'm looking forward to someday crossing paths with him and exploring more if there's some work to be done there at East Forest. But I'm glad that at least the album and the music is a small part of that experience. And I applaud them for the work that they're doing and the risks that they're taking. This music that you're hearing in the background, this is a song called Lucent, and it is from that album, Music for Mushrooms, soundtrack for the Psychedelic Practitioner. You can get that digitally, and coming in 2020 in the winter, there's going to be a vinyl version of the record. That's a series of excerpts but I think you'll enjoy that. It's called Spores, and that's coming soon. If you enjoy this podcast, we just hit 100 ratings, which I'm so excited about. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Giving it a rating on at least Apple Podcasts is stupid easy. You just scroll down to the bottom when you get back to the list of shows, all the way to the bottom, and just hit the 5-star thing. Done. So if you can do that right now, you can do it over and over again. Please do. And if you want to write a review, even better. Just got this review. The most recent one is from Wynn Journier, which says, gratitude, 5 stars. I recently listened to your podcast with Cody. Deeply appreciate the beauty of the discussion, the sharing of your journey, and Cody's insights. Thank you. Well, you're very welcome, Wynn Journier. Wynn Journier. It's hard to say. Wynn Journier. But I really appreciate those comments. I do read them, and it helps other people consider diving in. So please do it yourself. If you're in China, I'll see you soon. I'll see you Australia in February 2020. Check out those dates online. You know how it goes. Hey, you keep walking your walk. Don't take any shit. But if you do, folks, do it with grace. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.